Absolute, and this evening we're privileged to have Stephen Cool here from the Rotary Club of Arroyo Grande. Will lead us in the flag salute. If you please remain standing, Pastor Robert Underwood is here from First United Methodist Church
to lead us in the invocation.
Please face the flag and join with me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Honorable council members and good citizens, let us pray. Look graciously upon us, O Lord, and upon our city, adorned with its seasonal lights, sparkling in the night. Where our city is apathetic, we ask that you supply us with compassion. Where it is in need, provide us with resources. Where there is misdirection, give us sound guidance. And where our community holds to what is just and kindly and good, give us encouragement. Give us your light and your truth, and let them embrace us. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. Stephen, you know the custom. If you're here for the flag salute, we also get to hear about the work of Rotary in the community, and if you'd just enlighten us a little bit on some of the activities, that would be good.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. I bring you greetings on behalf of the Rotary Club of Arroyo Grande. Our club is one of four Rotary clubs in South County, the others being Pismo of Five Cities that Mr. Adams is a member of, Grover Beach, and Napomo. We're one of 26,000 plus Rotary clubs around the world, and I'm one of over 1.2 million Rotary members. We are by far the largest service organization in the world. The motto of Rotary is service above self, and just like you council members serve the community in the things that you do, we Rotarians serve both the close community and the world in the things that we do. Several years ago, we rebuilt the Swinging Bridge, and of course, a couple of years ago, we had the privilege of working with your city and the staff in building the Rotary Bandstand, which we're very proud of. I know you're proud of it, and we thank you for just giving us the opportunity to build that fine addition to the community. On the international level, Rotary International does a vast array of things to make the world a better place, from literacy to drilling wells so villages in third world countries can have clean water, to treating eye diseases, and on and on. The real flagship project of Rotary International has been what's called the Polio Plus program. I'm sure you've heard of it. And that is a program to eliminate polio from the face of the earth. It was started about 20 years ago, and it has reduced the incidence of polio by over 99%. So it's just a dramatically successful program, and all of us Rotarians are very proud to have been a part of it. So I thank you for the chance to say a few words about Rotary, and we look forward to further projects in your wonderful city. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Stephen, if you would please send back our best regards for the holidays to the Rotary membership, and we're very grateful to have you in our community and appreciate all the fine work that you do.
I will indeed. Thank you.
That will take us to item five this evening, special presentations, and we do have a presentation this evening by the Economic Vitality Corporation. Before you get up, Mike, I have just another brief announcement, and I think this falls under the category of special presentations. If it doesn't quite, we'll make it fit anyway. One of the things that the city has been attempting to do is to extend kind of a sense of unity and spirit that we enjoy in the village out onto Grand Avenue, East Grand Avenue. And one of the things that we've done over the course of the past year or so, working in conjunction with the Chamber of Commerce, is establish what's known as an East Grand Avenue Village Association and or Merchants Association. And this year, one of the events that we tried to sponsor out on East Grand Avenue was a Christmas decorating contest. And we had quite a few takers this year. And it's my privilege, it was my privilege yesterday to act as one of the judges, and I want to underscore the fact that I was only one of the judges. And the second place in that category went to Coast Bank. And then in the small business category, we had a number of locations that were just really special. One stood out, and so it's my, again, my pleasure. We'll refer to this one as the grand prize winner on the corner of Halcyon and East Grand Avenue, the Starving Artist Picture Framing store at 914 East Grand Avenue. Was the grand prize winner, and it was a tough choice because there was a very close runner-up, and that was Grand Bouquet Florists at 1355 East Grand Avenue. So we really appreciate the spirit and the involvement of all of our businesses on Grand Avenue, and also want to announce that there will be a brief award ceremony tomorrow morning at 9:45 a.m., and that will be in the Spencer Center at Cortland and Grand Avenue. So we're looking forward to making those presentations tomorrow. We want to congratulate all of the entries. Okay, now we'll go ahead with our formal special presentation from the Economic Vitality Corporation. We're pleased this evening to have Mike Manchek with us, who's the Executive Director.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the Council. I appreciate you having me here. The EVC, the Economic Development Vitality Corporation, the city is an investor in that, in effect. It's a sponsor of the organization. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the last year and what we're planning to do. First and foremost, I want to thank Ed Arnold, a board member of the EVC and a committee member on a very active committee we have, as well as former board member Jim Guthrie. So I want to thank you both for helping with the EVC. As a background, it's in its 13th year. It's a nonprofit organization, and it's really the county's only economic development group. So we help the county itself as well as each of the seven cities and then the unincorporated areas as well. And it really provides resources to help start and expand businesses. That's really what it's all about. Economic development in other areas of the country are very often about business attraction, so moving a company to the area. That's not a very good fit for this county. So we're really trying to grow our own. And really, we have almost every resource necessary. And if we don't, our partners do. And I'll talk about that in a bit. We have not yet filled, but we'll do that probably in 2008. And economic gardening is the kind of philosophy that we foster. So economic gardening really means that you're trying to grow your own businesses as opposed to attracting them. And it's really about resources and connections. The resources in the county for businesses are actually very robust. The hard part is just connecting the resources with the people that need them. And with the partners that we have, it's a challenging job, but it's something that I think it's paying benefits. And we'll talk a bit about that. The county, compared to other counties in the state, actually has one of the highest rates or percentages of sole proprietorships. And part of that reason, we think, is because of the lack of job opportunities. So a lot of people are saying, you know what, I've just got to start my own business. And that's what we're helping them do. So we're growing and attracting and expanding. Attracting once in a while where it makes sense, where it's synergistic with existing industries that are here in the county. It doesn't happen very often. But there are industry sectors for which are here that where we can attract a company that works with existing businesses or helps them. Here's some of the resources. The loan programs is probably one of our more important resources, and that's where we will actually help to guarantee business loans for people. We work with all the banks in the county, and we actually use federal money through HUD to guarantee those loans. And we actually take the cash, and the cash goes in the bank. So we don't actually guarantee them other than just using that money. We have also, for those businesses that are looking for something other than a bank loan, we have a venture capital network. And last March, we had our first event. We brought in about 25 to 30 VCs and angel investors from around the state. And we connected about 75 businesses from all over the county and helped them find an investor. We're going to do that again this coming March, and we're looking forward to that. Jobs Network, that's really more about using our network within the system where a company locally is looking to fill a position. We can help them do that. Workshops and seminars, we keep doing those on a variety of ways. And in fact, we've now, in the last year, we've done them via the internet, so they're called webinars. It's very helpful because you've got, for instance, businesses in Rio Grande, in the village, who say, I can't leave my business and go anywhere to go take a course. So this enables them to just look on their computer screen and take that course. Site selection service kind of speaks for itself. We help businesses find locations. Business counseling through some of our partners. And then I'll talk a little more about the last one, which is economic studies and strategies. These are our partners, Mission Community Services, the Private Industry Council, SCORE, and then also the Small Business Development Center. We've taken the approach of also helping these organizations get better known, because the reality is that there's very little competition amongst these nonprofits, but it's important that people understand what they do and why they do it, and how these organizations and the EBC can help them start a business or expand their business. Sponsors, again, City of Rio Grande is a very important sponsor, and we really appreciate that. Here's just a list. You can't read it because they're too small. But they have been growing in the last year about 55%. We now have over 100 sponsors. And on the right side is actually a list of the loan fund contributors. That I talked about the loan program. We actually have a separate loan program for microloans, and that does not come through federal money. That's actually the banks that invest those monies into a pool, and we lend those out. Some of the highlights, industry cluster studies. We think this is a very important place for us to do this work. We've started with the wine study. It determined a $1.8 billion industry in this county, and it made very important recommendations, not about planting more vineyards. Much of the recommendations were about creating more high-paying jobs, and it was very explicit as to how to do that. So we were able to commission that with the Wine Country Alliance in Paso Robles, and that was fairly successful. The next study we're going to do is on tourism, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. The venture capital event we'll have in March, we'll have another one, as I say, international trade course, that starts in January. And then we had an energy event talking to businesses about the future of energy costs, and Sam Blakesley was a keynote for that. Two Fridays ago, we had an event in Paso Robles with Congressman McCarthy. It was a business fair, and it brought federal speakers on various levels, whether the Import-Export Bank, grants, et cetera, basically connecting resources from the federal government to these businesses. So we were pleased to be part of that. The webinars, I talked about that. And we had a county, a radio show called County Biz. It was really an interview of business people from all over the county. It was a fantastic show, told their story. KVEC was in the news today in the paper about bringing that show back. So we'll see what happens. Several thousands of entrepreneurs and then hundreds of businesses we've helped start and expand. The loan programs, we have two loan programs, just so you know. One is about $15,000 max. The other is about $150,000 max. But there's a lot of businesses in the county that were helped purchase or start through the EBC that are now statewide. So we're very happy for that. The economic impact studies that I've talked about, the wine studies completed, the tourism study, for which we're wanting the City of Rio Grande to help support that. We're going to try to launch that in January of 2008. And then we have a daycare research project. There seems to be an issue throughout the county where businesses and employees are finding it difficult to find daycare. So what we're doing, we've got an intern who specializes in that who's going to do a research paper and basically connect resources to help employees find models that have worked elsewhere in the country. There's no sense that we should reinvent the wheel, but let's look outside of the county to figure out how are things being done elsewhere successfully to provide that resource for employees. And in turn, that helps the businesses. Business incubator, we're going to do a study on figuring out what the market feasibility is for incubators throughout the county to start businesses in that way. A countywide economic development strategy, that's a long-term project we're working with the county on. And then we've got an online directory of technology companies that we've just helped start. We also have a next slide, a Economic Development Professionals Group, for which Rob Strong is a part of, we've fostered a group that goes all over the county. It's made up of county chamber executives, as well as city executives, and also county. And what we do is we tour each city, and we were last in Roy Grant. It was a fantastic tour where we've learned about, you know, the pluses and minuses of practices in economic development, starting businesses, development, et cetera. And it's been great, and we're going to continue to do this and really learn from each other and create partnerships. And partnerships are actually happening from that, so we're happy about that. A little bit about the tourism study. This is a very important project. It's one of the biggest projects we've ever commissioned. We hope to do so in January. It's really two parts. It's providing an economic impact of the county's tourism industry, one of the largest industries in the county. But it's also going to use the best people possible to make recommendations as to how to create more health or vitality in that industry sector. It's arguably $1 to $2 billion minimum of an industry in this county. So we with the state study, they're very, very highly qualified. So we're pleased for that. Next slide, please. A little bit, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the economy locally. And for those that were not able to make it to the UCSB Economic Forecast Project that happens yearly, it happened in mid-November. And really the highlights is something I think it's very important to kind of look at. The bad first, and then the good, and then the recommendations. The county's economy only grew about 1% in the last year. That's the worst in about 10 years. County population grew by about 1%. In some communities, they're actually shrinking, and some are growing. But what was pointed out is that there's a lot of young people that don't have opportunities that are having to leave. Too much emphasis on government jobs. That's something we've heard time and again. Again, part of what the EVC does is to help create private sector jobs. Bill Watkins, who does this forecast, he says time and again, we need more private sector jobs. The good is soft. The U.S. dollar is actually creating more exports from this country. And it's causing a bright spot for next year in the local economy to be tourism and ag, and partly being helped by the soft dollar. Home foreclosure rates are below the rest of the state, so at about 13%. So I think that's an unfortunate situation, but at least we're at a lower rate than the rest of the state. The national economy is doing very well, although a lot of people have a lot of concerns and uncertainty about the national economy. So it grew at about 3.9% in two consecutive quarters, which is very high. The state economy is actually doing very well, and partly because of the technology sector in Silicon Valley. But bright spots, as I say, ag and tourism for 2008. And recommendations, again, local economy needs more private sector jobs, and the kinds of jobs that are tradable goods and professional services. That's what he recommends. Next slide, please. There is a newsletter that we do that highlights businesses in the county, Central Coast Business Watch. We've got a circulation of about 50,000. It's downloadable from the website, and has a lot of good information about what goes on in the county. Next slide. I think I've got about two more slides, and I'll be done. The website, a lot of good information. We're very proud. We're going to subscribe to a new model, a suite of business tools that will be going in January. Again, lots of rich content then get back into business. Now, this applies to governments as well, local governments. Very important. Can save lives and could save a lot of business as well. Venture capital event, I talked about that. We'll do that in March. And then the international trade course starts in January. And that is it. If anyone has any questions, I would be happy to take them. But I just want to thank the city and the council for the support for the EVC. I think there's a lot of good that's coming from this, and we're excited about the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Anyone have any questions or comments for Mike?
Thank you.
I have a couple. The last slide that you showed on the emergency preparedness seminar.
Yes.
And you mentioned you were working with the governor's office on that. Are you working with the Office of Emergency Services?
We are including the OES, and also we are being supported by SCORE, as well as the Small Business Advocate Office, which is part of the governor's research and planning arm. Marty Keller is the director of that, and he's personally involved in this process. So,
okay. Well, you might check with OES, the Office of Emergency Services, because I worked there for almost 21 years, and we did exactly the same thing for both government and the private sector. And you might also check with this guy here, because he currently works at the California Specialized Training Institute, which is the training arm of OES. Okay. And they may well be able to help shortcut, you know, some of this. I don't mean to put you on the spot, Joe, but I know we used to have a tremendous amount of material in this area, specifically for businesses. The other question I had, Mike, was on the tourism industry study. Conspicuously absent from your presentation was any mention of the Visitors Conference Bureau. I didn't see them up there. But what work are you doing with them? Or are you doing anything with them?
We are. In fact, they are supporting the study in the amount of $10,000, working closely with Johnny Biagini on this project. In fact, their chair, Myrlene Morris Whitaker, is actually on the committee that is creating this project. What I did not mention, too, is that, and I'm glad you asked the question, the part of the study
lately is the discussion back and forth about either the countywide business improvement district or, in some cases, I believe Paso Robles is looking at something more local. San Luis Obispo City is looking at something potentially that they would do on their own. Does the EVC have a sort of a dog in this fight? Have you guys landed on a position in terms of the business improvement district concept?
You know, we don't. And I think the reason we don't is that we're not tourism experts. I think that that's one more reason why I think this study is very important, the countywide portion, because it's going to look at all the best practices for a BID. This project, the tourism study, is being supported by two of the other cities you mentioned. But again, I think the experts need to tell or at least recommend what this county should do on a BID. So, but I think it's a very good question you ask, and I think that we're just not tourism experts, and we should really rely upon experts for that.
Okay. Thanks. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that will take us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Okay, hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward with any thoughts, observations, suggestions on issues that are not published on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your remarks to 3 minutes or less, and please address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward on item 7, community comments? No one? Okay. We'll close our first community comments and suggestions period, and we'll move to item 8, which is the consent agenda. And for those of you who are following along on our agenda this evening, the consent agenda is normally a group of items that we approve in one motion, unless there are individual items that we would pull out for independent action or further clarification. This is all. I would like to pull 8M briefly. I don't know if Rob's in the back or perhaps you can address it. It's the streetscape. Steve? While we're doing that, I'll entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8L.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anything to read in there this evening?
There are two ordinances, Mayor Ferrara. They're both in item 8L. One is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande repealing and replacing Chapter 16.80 of Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding the city's inclusionary affordable housing requirements. And the second is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adding Chapter 16.82 to Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding the city's density bonus and affordable housing incentives in accordance with state density bonus law.
Okay. Any discussion? Any further discussion? Hearing none. Did we do a motion on this? We did. Roll call, please.
Council Board Member Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Vice Chair Arnold?
Yes.
Council Board Member Costello?
Yes.
Council Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Chair Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Rob, just briefly on 8M. I know some of the issues that we're going through right now with, compliance and Caltrans and relinquishment and design exceptions and all of that. And I also know that I understand that the costs are escalating for the streetscape project. But I was wondering, two questions, and if you could refresh my memory, the original plan, did it include electricity out at the curb? And also, did we at one point discuss irrigation that might be available as well? I know that it was, I thought that we had discussed it, but it was pretty expensive. But I as long as we're sort of unwrapping some of this, I wanted to make sure that we at least considered these two things.
The original concept did include a potential for electricity. There was potted planters for the street trees, and therefore no specific irrigation system proposed.
That might be beneficial is that if we could do a cost estimate for those so that we can see what the additional cost would be, then I can take that back to SLOCOG and see if there's any way we can get some additional supplemental funding.
Excellent. We will.
Okay.
And then I just want to add that item will be presented to the council at the January 8th meeting, the full plan.
January 8th? Okay. Yeah. Very good. With that, I'll move approval at 8 a.m.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
One thing that I forgot to do, the Mayor Pro Tem just reminded me, is that prior to the council meeting starting this evening, the council did meet in closed session on several items related to property acquisition and labor issues. We have no report at this time. During that process, it was necessary for me to step out on one item, and I'm assuming from the Mayor Pro Tem that there's no report on that item.
There was no report either.
Okay. All right, then we will move to item 9, our first public hearing this evening. This is a consideration of an application of a new certificate of public conveyance supplied for by Grover Beach Taxi. Good evening, Chief.
How are you?
Wonderful.
Okay. This is an existing business that operates in the city of Arroyo Grande and has had no negative contact with the police department. The requested changes have no financial impact on the city for Arroyo Grande, and should the council approve the request, they will be required. The applicant will be required to comply with the following prior to issuance of the certificate of public convenience and necessity. They will need to submit their vehicles for the taxis for inspection by the police department. They will also have to supply evidence of the required insurance. Obtain taxi permits from the police departments for all their drivers, and obtain a city business license along with submitting a current rate schedule to the city clerk's office. This taxi company is changing its name, and they have already been approved by the Grover Beach Council on November 5th of 07 and a 5-0 vote.
Okay. Is that it? Anyone have any questions or
For pickups between the hours of 2:30 a.m. and 5:30 a.m.
Pickup. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
Just one quick question, just because I'm confused a little bit. Are they adding taxis as well as changing their name? Are they going from one to three taxis? Am I
yes, they're going correctly? To go into three.
Okay. All right.
Six. I'm sorry, three to six.
Three to six. So they're adding three taxis. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, this is a public hearing. Any member of the audience who would like to come forward on 9A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. No one? Okay, we'll close the public hearing portion of 9A, bring this back to council, and why don't we start with Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have no objections to the changes that are proposed by the applicant on this issue. They're expanding their fleet by three, and my understanding is that there will be a continuation of three cabs being available to the Five Cities area. It's a change in name and ownership and expansion of the fleet, and at this point it should have no direct impact on our community, so I can support this as it's before us tonight.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Fellows.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. When I first saw these figures, I thought they were high, but according to staff, they're competitive, and that was my concern, so I have no trouble supporting this tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie?
Yeah, I do have no trouble supporting. I think the additional cabs in the community will be a plus, so I'm looking forward to that. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
I have nothing to add. I can support this tonight. Thank you.
Okay. I'll make it unanimous. I also agree that additional cabs in the area would indeed be a convenience. With that, I'll entertain a motion for approval of the resolution.
Mr. Mayor, I move we adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Royal Grande granting a certificate of public conveyance and necessity to 234 Taxi LLC for the operation of a taxicab service within the city limits, contingent upon full compliance with all conditions and requirements of Title V, Chapter 5.72, Taxicabs of the Royal Grande Municipal Code.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes, thank you. All right, we'll move.
So that they'll be able to answer them. The need to determine the cost of providing services to individuals and businesses was recognized in 2006. The City Council approved a contract with Wolford Consulting, and the study began in September of 2006. The last user fee study was prepared began in 1999 and ended and was adopted April in 2000. And the departments that were included in that study at the time were Community Development, Engineering, Fire, and Parks and Rec. Building was not part of that study because it was recommended that they go with the 1997 UBC codes. So. The basic concept of a user fee study is to determine the full cost of the service provided by the city for which the city charges a user fee. The costs calculated in the study represent the estimated full cost for each service and therefore the maximum fee that the city could charge for its services. Once the full cost is known, the city can determine what portion of these costs should be recovered through user fees and what portion, if any, is appropriate for the city to subsidize. Once the full cost recovery amounts were determined, staff reviewed each fee to determine the necessary recovery amount. The following items were taken into consideration: full cost recovery recommendations, comparison with fees charged by other jurisdictions in the county, degree to which service for the underlying fee benefits only the fee payer versus a general public good and or customer service goal, ability of the targeted customer to assume increase, amount of the increase over the current fee necessary to meet the cost recovery recommendation, and potential compliance problems that may occur related to the fee amount. Staff has attempted to recommend recovery levels that are equitable to the individuals and or businesses receiving the services and fair to the general public who subsidize them. It is recommended in the study that building permit fees be adopted 100%. According to the survey of other surrounding cities, the City of Rio Grande's recommended building fees for the most common projects will still be near the median range. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad to give his presentation on this study.
Good evening. I've prepared a
PowerPoint presentation to frame my comments. The purpose of this presentation, I have several purposes and goals for this evening. One of them is to provide a basic orientation for this study. Ultimately, what I want to get to is the results, right? So you can see what the numbers are. But I want to provide some context, the key things. I believe you have copies of the slides, so you can see what's on there for the points that I went through. Ultimately, if you have any questions as we go through this, please interrupt me at any time. I'd be glad to answer them then so that we can take care of that before we move on to something else. Again, my name is Chad Wolford. I run a consulting practice. I've been doing this for a number of years, very experienced in the field. I won't go through all of my background, but you can look at the list there. I am an experienced consultant in this area, so you can have confidence that it was done right, it was done well, and the results are very, very defensible. Let me talk a little bit about the study as a whole. The objectives of this study, first and foremost, is to understand the full cost of services. We call it a fee study, but as Angie mentioned, the full cost establishes kind of the maximum that you can charge based upon state law. So that's the end result of this study, was simply to calculate full cost and put everything in there that was legitimate. By having the full cost established, comparing it to your current fees, we can look at what your subsidies are. And the subsidies, we're defining it as, if you're not charging full cost, the gap between those two is a subsidy that you're providing to the fee payer. You're going to be asked to set fees. It's the council's prerogative to set fees at whatever level you deem is appropriate. And part of the study and part of the comments tonight is to try and give you a context to make that decision. If you haven't already come to a conclusion from reading. We went dead here. Is there a power strip?
Where's that techie?
Oh, this power source isn't.
Please hold.
Power sources.
We got that connected to electricity? It looks like it's running off its battery.
Okay, good.
Do we need an engineer?
You can go home now, Don.
Sorry, Chad.
Did they cover that in your engineering curriculum, Don? Yeah.
Don, what's the fee?
I'm going to move on from there. Not going to go back.
Is it not working now?
All right.
Hit escape and maybe it'll go out. We have to go back in.
Not that one.
That's okay. Just go back.
It's good.
Just close that one out.
There
and
we go. Goes. All right. Okay. Ready to go again. I think the microphone stopped working too, right? Ultimately, there are some state laws that guide what you can charge, and so we wanted to make sure that the study kept the city in compliance with those state laws. And finally, one of the main goals that I always like to put in is, if you have a particularly complex fee schedule that is difficult for staff to administer, for your citizens and customers to follow and understand, it's important to try and simplify them as much as possible. So wherever we could do that, we tried to do that as well. All right. The departments listed here are the ones that we included in the study. It didn't include every department in the city. It's really the main ones where there's a cost-effective view at the fees that they charge. An important thing to keep in mind in this study is that the study is a study of the cost of service at the current performance levels. So whatever the departments are doing now, as they're doing it, the way their business models are, the way their business practices are, that's what we looked at. It was not a management study where we tried to identify whether they're doing things well or whether they're being cost-effective, or whether their performance is efficient. It wasn't looking at anything like that. It was simply a cost analysis of how they're doing business right now. Some of the concepts of user fees, I want to go through some of those briefly here, and then get into some of the more details of this study. Angie mentioned this before. Really, what a user fee is it's something that you're charging when someone receives a private benefit for a service you provide. So it's not general police patrol. It's not general fire service and fire response, et cetera. It's if somebody comes in here and they're going to achieve some sort of service or receive some sort of service directly from city staff, that's typically where we find a user fee. It's not taxes. It's not impact fees. Impact fees are for infrastructure development. And certainly there are gray areas. Obviously, we need a category of being taxes themselves. User fees, typically, we think of them as not arbitrary. They're supposed to be based upon something. The service that we receive, the cost should be related to that somehow. They shouldn't be unfairly subsidized, meaning somebody else pays a lot more to make up for somebody who isn't paying their fair share. So there's a few issues like that that should be kept in mind when you're thinking of user fees. They should be fair and equitable to all payers. They should be, with everything else being equal, they should be consistent with what your goals are as city council and as staff in the city and so forth to make sure that they're accomplishing what you're trying to accomplish within the city. And there's a lot of things that you can do in terms of fee setting, and I'll get into some of that in a moment, that can affect what your goals and objectives are. Certainly compliant with state law, and you need fees that can follow what happens later. After this fee study is done, after you set these fees, things may change. So we want to make sure that the fee structures and the fee schedules can handle anomalous situations, things that we couldn't think of. Certainly we can't think of everything when we do the study, so we want to make sure it's there. The discussion I want to go through here for a few minutes is for you, and it's also for members of your public who may not understand why are there user fees? Why is there so much user fees? Why do they seem so high? Why do I have to pay fees for everything? And so I want to go through kind of a brief outline of the history, if you will, of user fees. They've sort of been around forever, but they haven't been a major source of revenue, and they haven't been a major part of your budget until really the last 20 or 30 years. So I want to go through what that history has been. And basically it all goes back, as just about every financial issue we talk about in local government, goes back to Prop 13. Because before Prop 13, if you needed additional revenue, you didn't worry about raising fees, you raised property taxes. And Prop 13 really put an end to that and caused there to be pretty severe limitations on what local government revenues could be. After Prop 13, which as you know, limited property tax, there's several other things that were sort of like cleanup activities after Prop 13, one of them being Prop 4, which is where the idea of a tax versus a fee was established, a tax being something where you charge more than the cost of a service. That becomes the definition of a tax, basically. And then Prop 218, which came a little bit later, established the requirement that you have to have a supermajority vote in order to institute a tax. So if any of the services that we looked at in this study, for example, you wanted to charge a major source of revenue for local government as well. And so all of this stuff together really puts a damper on revenues that local government can collect. And so what happened was, obviously you don't have revenue, and yet at the same time, citizens are always clamoring, as we all do, for more and more services. We want more things from our government, from our stores, from everybody and everywhere. And so we've kind of got this situation where people want more services, the revenues are restricted, and even some of the revenues we're still getting have things like, you have mandates that services you have to provide. State passes laws that says you're going to do these things, and we may or may not give you revenue for that, but you're going to have to do it, so there's more services that you have to provide. There's matches. If you get money, you're going to have to put up some of your own general fund money. There's maintenance of effort, that whatever level you've been spending at, you have to stay at that to get these additional funds. So all of these have created restrictions, limitations, rules that you have to follow on your revenue. Just completely eliminated, not completely, but almost completely eliminated your flexibility for revenue. So what happens? The cities, counties, special districts, local government said, we need some help. State, you're killing us here. And so what happened, the state said, in addition to, of course, cities and counties reducing services, the state said, well, you can go charge more fees and you can charge impact fees. So basically the state said, you have more authority to go do this, but that means you have more responsibility for it. You're now in charge of tracking and following and regulating and doing all of that. So really you got more opportunity to charge fees, but more responsibility on top of that. The other things that the state did is, yeah, they give you more authority to charge fees, but at the same time they put more restrictions on what those fees are, further restricting your flexibility. Then what happened was, because cities were kind of in a fix and they had to get more revenue, and they really pushed fees. Some cities in particular really went wild and pushed fees very, very hard, raised fees in an attempt really to get around some of these other restrictions and gain more revenue. Well, some of them got hammered by lawsuits from developers and those sorts of things, where it was litigated that they can't be charging more than full cost. The Attorney General came out with an opinion that said you can't charge more than full cost. The Legislative Council of California came out with the same thing. Appellate judges have said the same thing. So you've ended up in a situation where now it's been scrutinized, and cities and counties that were user fees are under scrutiny. They're frequently challenged. And so you have to do a methodology, you have to do a fee analysis that can support can withstand, I should say, any sort of challenges. And so that was really one of the major things that we did here, was develop a study. The methodology is developed, of course, but apply that methodology here and use due diligence and good scrutiny of the data and everything to make sure that we have a study that can withstand that kind of scrutiny. All right. Once we have that full cost analysis, it's time for staff to make recommendations and for council to set fees. And there's a series of issues that you can consider when setting fees. One of them I mentioned before, that fees should really match what you're trying to accomplish as a city. And so fees as a whole should be consistent with what you have set as city public policy, city fiscal policy, such as how much cost you want to recover, what type of subsidies you want to provide. Until you know what those subsidies are, it's hard to establish policy and hard to comply with policy if the subsidies are just kind of this nebulous figure out there, as opposed to something that we've calculated in this example. City goals for revenue enhancement: if you want to incentivize or disincentivize certain activities, you would establish fees that are particularly high or particularly low in order to kind of guide behavior. Again, fairness and equity, you've seen that a couple of times now. Impact on demand, I kind of went quickly through that. If you raise fees to a certain level, you're going to reduce the demand for those fees, for those services. Now, you may not reduce fully the demand for people doing the thing that you're trying to charge the fee for. What you end up perhaps is with a lot more unpermitted development or people doing things where they should be getting fees and aren't. So it's important to keep that in mind when you set your fees as well. Legal compliance is a given. And then, of course, some of the political issues that you might personally have, if you set your fees, even if they are related to full cost and yet they're higher, grossly higher than all surrounding communities, may be something that you're concerned about as well. This is more of a visual way of looking at how you might set fees and how you might subsidize. And I kind of categorize it into four groupings. Obviously, there's a long continuum and a lot of degrees that fall in the middle here, but to give you a sense of what the thought is here, is we have on the far left the first category called what I call 100% private benefit. That's something like building recreation. You get youths involved, that sort of thing, which has a reduction potentially in juvenile crime and delinquency and so forth. And so there's some general public benefit to it, but there's a lot of private benefit because the people taking classes and involved in sports are personally getting a benefit out of that. Some private benefit would be something like advanced planning, where mostly advanced planning is about planning the city for the future and the quality of life issues and that kind of thing, reducing traffic, et cetera. But also that advanced planning is helping some developers identify a place to go build for zoning and so forth. So there's some private benefit there, but mostly it's a public benefit. And then police patrol is the classic example of a general community benefit. And so that's something that basically should be funded by taxes, when the other end of the spectrum is funded by fees. So this is just trying to represent that the two points of that spectrum. All right, for a little bit here, I want to talk about the specific methodology that we went through here. Basically, I'm not trying to train you in how to do a fee study. What I want to do is impress upon you the level of detail, the level of rigor that went in here, so that you can have complete confidence in the results that come out of this. So, in short, as I mentioned before, we base the study on the current city practices. Okay, what are they doing now? How long is it taking? How are they doing it? Who's doing it? Those are the things that we're focusing on. A tax concept is when you try and figure out how much money you need as the starting point. I need X dollars, and so I'm going to build a fee that gets me to X dollars. That's a tax approach. As opposed to building it from the ground up, which is who's working on it, how long does it take them, what are they paid, what are the benefits, what's the overhead, a build up that way. And it's a much more defensible way to go about it. It's much more accurate approach to do it. The calculation factors we used, and I'm going to show a detail in a moment on that, is how long does it take for someone to complete a task? What is their hourly rate? A times B equals the cost of the service once we load in overhead and all the other additional costs. Ultimately, as we've said a couple times now, the full cost is the maximum potential fee. Now, this is simply a list. You can read it later, but just want to show you that the cost that we built in here, the cost of the services, are city costs. It's a fully loaded, all the people who are involved with it, all of the services and supplies that are involved with it, all of the other budgeted expenditures, as well as cross-departmental support, overhead, et cetera. It's a fully loaded cost designed to recover 100% of the cost. Going to doing a fee, and I have a generic fee number one here, where there's an intake for the say a permit application to come in. There might be a plan check. There might be an inspection. There's some filing and closeout, et cetera. And in this example here, we're showing you that the employee who did this spent a half hour in intake, an hour on plan check, 2 hours on inspection, half hour in filing, et cetera, 4 hours. And at a hypothetical hourly rate of $100, you can see how we calculate out the cost for just this position to be working on fee number one. So we've calculated $400 for this fee. Okay. Once we have that salary and benefit costs, we allocate the benefits and services, supplies, all those budgeted costs also. And we got a hypothetical $50 here. So a total cost, so the base cost of this fee, or the full cost of this fee, excuse me, would be $450 per incident. In this example also, I have an annual volume of 10. So you do 10 of them a year. So it's the equivalent of $4,500 a year in cost associated with this particular fee. So this is the mechanism that we went through, this time times an hourly rate, add on the service and supplies and overhead. We come up with a full cost, unit cost, and then we multiply it out by the annual number of them. That's how we come up with some of the revenue figures. This is what the revenue figures look like. In this case, now I have multiple fees in here, hypothetically, and we've got the annual volume of each. And the key thing here is we've got a current fee listed here, and this is how we come up with the subsidy of the gap analysis. We have a current fee of $100, and if there's 10 of them a year, it's $1,000 a year in anticipated revenue under your current fee system. If the actual cost is $4,500 for 10 of them a year, then we know we have an annual subsidy or a gap of $3,500 a year. So it's pretty simple conceptually, just that we did this 1,000 times. And that's why the packet you have is an inch or two thick, because there's this type of analysis was done with for every single fee, and every single fee had every single employee in that department factored into every single fee to the extent that they actually worked on that fee activity. So in this case, what we're seeing here is that we've got, for fee number one, $3,500 gap, $875 here. In these two examples, I just threw in the occasion when you might be currently overcharging instead of undercharging. So, and these are really designed to get us to that point where we can meet the state standard, which is that the cost can be no greater than the fee can be no greater than the estimated reasonable cost of providing the services. So we had to make sure that even if we used estimates, that everything is reasonable. So we had a number of activities, quality control activities that we went through, starting with providing the proper guidance, using my experience, my exposure to other studies and other things to make sure I'm giving proper instruction when I collect data. Applying that experience when I see information and data come in. There's a lot of places where I can look and staff could look and see the results start to come out, and they just don't look right. And so there's a lot of times when we went back in and had to ferret out errors or misconceptions or misunderstandings in the data until we were all satisfied. The study wasn't just me coming in, grabbing some city documents, preparing the study. It was a lot of meetings and sit-downs and phone calls and emails back and forth with the staff in the departments who are knowledgeable about the information and about the services within their department to make sure that they were fully involved, fully understand, and provide really good data to the study. The models have a series of reasonableness tests. There are cross-checks. There are warnings and red flags that literally pop up in the models to say something doesn't balance, something doesn't equate properly here. And when that happened and when I saw things, there was a lot of challenge and questioning. If you were to ask any of the folks involved in the study, they're I was going to say half sick of me, but some of them may be fully sick of me by now because of all the times I had to come back and say, this doesn't look right. Let's go through this again, until we were all really satisfied that it was good results, good data in, good results coming out of it. The consumption and balance of FTE is just one of those cross-checks that we have in there to make sure that all of the time we associate with staff doesn't go over 100% of their available time. That's a clear indication that something's wrong. If people are indicating with the data and all the calculations that I'm working 200% of my available time, it just doesn't happen. So a number of other steps. Ultimately, we reviewed it. Everything was okay. Then we decided that we're done. But it took a long time to get there because we had to make sure that everything was acceptable and everything was right. Okay, let's actually talk about results for a moment. You received a series of worksheets, basically, spreadsheets that have a lot of numbers on them. And it's important to note that the numbers that say were part of the consultant report, those aren't the recommended fees. Those are the full cost. As I said, results are not the fees. That's something you're going to be setting. And the way we're defining the subsidy, it's the gap between the fee and the full cost. And a really important thing to keep in mind is that these subsidies, the cost of providing these services, are not theoretical costs. These are your actual costs to provide these services. So if you don't charge fees that equal that cost, there is a subsidy. It's paid from somewhere. It doesn't just go away. And that generally is your general fund. Most of any other funding sources you have can't be used to offset that. So it's really your general fund that pays for the gap between your fee and the cost of services. And ultimately, the recommended fees, staff work together to develop those fees and provide that input to you. I'm going to move kind of through some of this. It's somewhat self-explanatory. One of the things about the revenue results is in the model, the revenue results themselves are based upon some assumptions of annual volumes, which are somewhat based upon our historical experience with those. A really good example of this might be building fees, that we've had a certain level of activity in building over the years and sort of builds our assumption of what's going to happen. But who knows what's going to happen next year, right? We don't know if building activity is going to plummet completely or for some strange reason spike again. And so I wouldn't encourage you to take the numbers that come out of the study and put them in your budget for next year. There's a lot more thinking that has to be done about what's really going to happen in the local economy, what's really going to happen with your activity before you know what those revenues are going to be. Another thing is if you were to take the revenues that we're projecting, even the revenues based upon current fees, and took those and compared them to, say, your last budget year, something like that, your last complete year, some of them are going to be kind of close. But others won't be close at all. There's a number of reasons for that. Some of them might be that there are certain fees that were in this study that or were not in the study, for example, that perhaps contribute to your revenue results. So, you know, you might see your budget has a certain level of revenue, but not all the fees we look at go to that. So there's a disconnect there. Some activities, particularly engineering-type activities, might cross multiple fiscal years. So you might collect the fee in 1 year but have to do the work in other years, and the volume shows in different years. So there's a number of reasons why they might not match up. And then ultimately, next year, the following year, revenues will change because the mix of services will change. If, for example, back to my building example, then following planning, I'm going to give you some of the detail from planning to show you how to maybe read some of the worksheets that you've received, if there's any question about that. But first of all, let me show you. Planning, the full cost and the of planning, and this isn't all of planning. This is of fee activities in planning. So we segmented out the non-fee stuff, the advanced planning, and those types of things. The fee-related activities and planning equates to about $713,000 a year. And your current revenue, based upon current fees, is about $128,000 a year, leaving you a subsidy or a gap of $585,000 a year. This is not unexpected. This is a typical finding of planning departments when I do fee studies. They tend to be significantly under-recovered. If you look at them as a whole with all the non-fee activities, it looks much worse than this. But even from the fee activities, this is not a surprising finding. Some of the details of it are every single fee in planning is under-recovering, we identified. As I mentioned, the overall current subsidy is $585, and the staff recommendations for new fees or for fee increases would add another $149,000 annually in revenue to the department's fee recovering or to the city as a whole. This is how it looks this is somewhat simplified, but generally it's the same view that you see in the worksheets that you received. The current fee deposit is really what you're charging on a unit basis now. That's this column here. And I just picked out some sample fees, and these are real data from the study. Your current fees, or a deposit if it happens to be a deposit, are listed here. Next to them, generally, you'll find in the worksheets in the results models that there's a full cost per unit calculation that's shown next to it, and then showing you the unit gap and the cost recovery rate. You'll see this in, for every department, you'll see this worksheet, except for instead of these 9 or 10 fees here, you'll see dozens or 100 or, in building's case, 200, 300, whatever it turned out to be ultimately, a lot. And in planning here, as I listed down below, that there's 61 total. So this just shows you a little piece to show you how we sort of array things across so you can see step by step the results on a unit basis. On a revenue basis, this is just another example. There's actually about 5 different views of this in the end results. Subsidy. In this case, the full cost of fee-related services included in the study is $133,000. Now, there are some certain activities that aren't included in here, so this isn't all of the revenue from engineering, but the parts that we looked at. The current revenue is about $39,000, a gap of 94, 29% cost recovery. In Public Works' case, almost all of the unit fees are under-recovering. There's 4 that are not. Those are small incremental add-ons to, I believe it was, grading inspections. And they have very, very low volume, so they don't really affect the, even though they're currently overcharged, if you set the fee down to a full cost level, it won't significantly affect your revenues because there's just so few of those that are done. And it still leaves you with an overall subsidy of $94,000. And recommended fees would bring an additional $26,000 annually on top of what they're currently collecting. Building is really the big animal here because they're significantly under-recovered, and the attempt to go to full cost recovery would result in about $205,000 annually in additional revenue. Now, even though building goes to 100% cost recovery for most everything, I believe there's a thing or two, water heater permits, that kind of thing, that aren't. And that results in the $1,000 difference between full cost and revenue. That's building. Fire, same story. Significant subsidy of fee-related activities. But fire activities tend to be things like if someone's going to have a festival or an event, the fire department wants to make sure to get permits. If someone's going to be cooking in a tent, And are they going to charge the $1,000 cost it takes for everyone to go out and take a look at it? Generally not. That's a typical activity that's heavily subsidized because it's a community activity. So in their case, even though there's a subsidy of $130,000, there'd be $9,000 in additional revenue if you were to set fees at the recommended level. Police, they do have certain fee activities, and they have a subsidy of $63,000. Recommended fees would bring an additional $25,000 annually. So these additional revenue figures are going to be on top of what they're currently collecting. All right. In summary, each department has a significant subsidy. The overall annual subsidy is $1 million. The cost recovery rate overall is about 32%. And as I said before, if you don't increase recover that much, you recover the appropriate proportion of that. This is what it looks like as a whole. We have each of the departments. I'm not going to go into detail here because you've seen the detail. It's just summarized. The one thing that you can see here is how the recommended fees will result in the $413,000. This is how it breaks down visually. Now, through the course of this study, we spent a lot of time talking with managers, frankly, of the departments and other key staff. And in addition to the numbers results that we came up with, there's a lot of other information that comes out of the study because we're looking at productive hours and productivity and how much time is spent on individual activities. All that data is now available to managers to take a look at it and realize if they are spending an inordinate amount of time on a particular activity, on a particular service, they now have the opportunity to look further into that. The data is available. There's things that they can look at. You also, of course, saw the revenue impacts. They can see, managers can see where staff is working, where they're spending all of their time. We've accounted for 100% of the time of all staff. And so they can see where they're spending that time, how it crosses services to know whether they're meeting priorities or they're focusing on things that aren't necessarily priorities. And the time to do each service is a efficiency issue you can look at. And also general staff productivity. We looked at what the productivity was in general by classification, and they can look and see if maybe there are some areas for improvement there. Now, these weren't areas where I focused on and provided recommendations and so forth, but it is data that's available to the staff. Almost done here. The next steps, really, the city staff has provided recommendations. I believe you're in possession of those. And once you establish those final fees and set an implementation date, there's just a couple more things that departments staff have to do, which are, frankly, significant. They're going to have to update their fee schedules, republish fee schedules, put them on the web if you're putting them on your website. If you have electronic permitting systems, which I believe you do, those are going to have to be updated with new tables for the new fees put in. So there's a bit of work that still needs to be done before they can be in place. But that's all right, because even if you approved them tonight, you can't implement them for 60 days. And so there is at least that period of time where a lot of those implementation steps can occur. That concludes my comments, except for meetings. We had two-hour meetings. We had hour, two-hour conference calls. There's a lot of time and effort that they had to put in to get this done on top of their regular workload. So I just want to thank them and acknowledge that and say how much I appreciate all of your effort, because this certainly can't be done without it. And certainly can't be done well without all of your input and review. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And that concludes my comments. If you have questions, I'm here till you don't need me anymore.
Okay. Thank you for that presentation, Chad. Very comprehensive. I do have one quick question, actually a couple of them. The people that you have in red up there, did they treat you better than the people in blue? What's the distinction there?
Those are people who owe me money from betting. And
I see.
No, just to keep them separated.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I was curious in reviewing this, and maybe this is a question for Angie and Steve. And I understand the considerations that you have listed on the top of page 3 of the staff report, which I concur with. But when we're looking at full cost recovery, do we have a sort of a blanket overhead or indirect that we start with? Does the city have a kind of a standard overhead or do we temper it? And the only thing I can compare it to is, you know, when it was budget time or contract time at the state level, I mean, we had a set overhead. It was like 30% that went on top of personnel services. And so do we have that here?
We do. We do a cost allocation plan, and we determine what it is. I can't remember right off the top of my head. Do you remember with the study if you had a certain amount?
In the case of citywide overhead, the cost allocation plan, the citywide overhead plan identified an overhead figure for each department. That figure was calculated into the fee analysis as an overhead factor, and it was spread among not only the fee-related activities but also non-fee-related activities. So it was proportionally and appropriately spread to the activities that are in there. So it's not a percentage applied or anything like that. It's an actual fixed number of administrative costs that gets built into the overall analysis.
And it's specific to each department? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. So, absolutely. And it could vary from department to department. If you were to convert it into a rate, a percentage, it could certainly vary dramatically from department to department.
Okay. The other quick question I had was there was reference throughout the study. And
so what we did, we determined we couldn't compare every single fee, but we took each department, met with each of the department directors, and kind of picked out those that we felt were most common and had each department do their own survey and come back with that. And we tried, in determining the fee levels, we tried to keep all the fees around the median, so that's what they're at. And we actually used that assessment in, you know, we went through these one by one and discussed all these issues that are listed there in terms of what the factors would go into our recommendation. And then one of those was that comparison, trying to keep it somewhere around the median point countywide. And the most significant increases are in the building permits. And with going to 100% cost recovery, we're still right around the median countywide, which indicates how far below those particular fees had fallen.
Okay. Well, the point that Chad made is certainly a valid one. I know from time to time in the various categories that are subject to these fees, you know, we hear rumblings in the community about, you know, how Arroyo Grande stacks up against other political subdivisions and their respective fee structures. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good. And I was just wondering if we had that information available.
The other relative thing I might like to add is this study did not look at development impact fees, which in the past have been fairly high a few years ago within the city, which were actually making us somewhat non-competitive in terms of attracting new projects into the city. So we've tried to hold those fairly steady to where the last survey we looked at, we're competitive in those fees now. And when looking at the cost to a particular project, while the building permit fees are going up, those costs are not going up. And those tend to be the most major cost to a developer. And so as far as the overall impact to a potential development, this will have an impact, but it's not a severe impact when you figure in all the fees that a project has to pay.
Questions, clarifications, and the presentation? No? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, I do, Mr. Mayor. Thank you. Chad, the current cost recovery rate, meaning right now, 32%. You didn't mention a percentage, I don't think, for what your recommended rates would bring us up to. You mentioned the dollar figures, but what would be the percentage?
You know, I didn't calculate that figure, so I don't have it offhand. I'm sorry.
Okay. How long did this study take?
About a year.
Okay. Say a special interest group does find fault with the fees that we decide to charge, if we accept your recommendations or even something close. In your experience, I think you've been doing this for quite a few years. Do you end up being testifying in a hearing such as that, say if there's a lawsuit, and I'll finish right there and let you answer that.
First, I'll tell you, in my experience, I've never heard of a successful challenge or a challenge that's even gone to court for a study that's been done like this, a cost-based study. It's never happened to my knowledge. The only cases out there are when someone did not do a cost-based study, based it on some other methodology. So
perfect. Thank you very much. That's all.
Okay. Any other questions, clarifications? Okay. While this is not a public hearing, we do invite members of the public to come forward on significant business items. This is certainly one of them. If anyone would like to come forward on 11A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Once again, please be mindful of the three-minute rule. Anyone? You guys are all too busy taking notes back there, right? This be a school project looming, I can see. Okay, we'll close public comment on 11A and bring this back to the council for a discussion and action, and we'll start with Council Member Fellows.
I'd like to just jump in and say I'm all for this, but I want to reserve my decision until after I hear from my colleagues. But it's obviously important for the city to not over-subsidize projects. We should only subsidize them from the tax from the general fund raised from taxes to the point of the benefit to the general public. That's obvious from Chad's presentation. If there's a 100% benefit to developer, for example, then we must recoup our costs so the study does serve the purpose of getting as close as possible to knowing just what our costs are. I think that's an awfully good result of the project, of the study. The study didn't compare the recommended fee structure to other local cities, but staff did and found that building fees and so on will still be at or near the median, very competitive with other cities. And the fact that the staff input helped customize the study's recommendations to what we do here, what our goals are, very, very helpful. I'm glad that was done to the degree that it was. And I have a great deal of faith in our staff. Every member of our staff that I know of has many, many years of experience, even the folks that are new to our city, such as the fire chief, the police chief, and so on. I think if we do... I have a feeling we might accept the recommendations. If we do, or if we change them a little bit, I think that every staff member should have, the folks that work the counters and so on, should have a copy of the current cost recovery rates, such as in the executive summary, so that if a member of the public doesn't understand the amount of the subsidy, we can help them understand that and see why the fee is what it is. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Well, first I'll say I was struck by how big the subsidies are, when it's, particularly on some of the, what I'll call the more generic, the building department permits, the things that really do have a direct private benefit and are really trackable. Some of the public hearing type things that are, you know, a little harder to establish what the real, because there's a benefit both ways. There's a private benefit clearly that the person who's developing the project has, but there's also a public benefit in that the public does have the review process in place to protect the public. The other observation I have, and I'll echo the comment that we should be real careful about just translating these fees directly into the budget, is that a number of these units that we use are actually the city is the applicant. For instance, the general plan amendment updates, the code updates, the city's often the applicant, so we would be paying ourselves, and obviously we wouldn't be able to budget for that. So there are a number of instances where that's why I think we have to be careful with trying to just translate $413,000 or whatever it was directly into our budget process. I am glad to hear that we're kind of always caught in this situation where we're competitive. Well, certainly we would love to have full cost recovery, but we do certainly have an obligation to be competitive with the other cities in our jurisdiction. Well, I guess we have an obligation to be, but certainly it's in our best interest to be competitive that in fact we don't put anyone who is working in our community at a disadvantage. So I can support the proposals. I certainly open to if there's some specific ones that other council people identified as maybe being a problem. I'm certainly open to looking at that, but they're certainly, there was nothing that I felt was overcharged. If anything, most of these are significantly subsidized, and I'm going to say almost have to be. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I very quickly say that I do support the proposal that's in front of us. We have been subsidizing a large number of the fees that are charged, and this is an attempt to bring these back into line. I do want to point out that we're not trying to get to full cost recovery in 1 year, which would probably be very difficult to do were we to try to do that. And that our philosophy is not going to make it full cost recovery on all fees at any rate, even when all is said and done. I think we're taking a prudent approach to doing this. The study was thorough and comprehensive, and the assumptions were fair and realistic. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to look at when I read through this and found them to be so. So I can support going forward with this, and I see no particular fees that I think will be out of line with the adjusted number we're trying to get to. I do think that we should be ready to explain to the public when they come in and ask why the fees have gone up, exactly why they've gone up. And I think that once laid out correctly, most people will probably understand the reason for the fees to go up and to realize that it's simply transferring the fact of them being subsidized by some other fee payer to people paying their fair share. So I can support this, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, this was quite the eye-opener for me as well. I do want to say thanks, everyone. This is obviously an extensive and complete report. I had no idea the subsidies were as what they are, and so I actually like the Councilman Fellow's idea of potentially having some kind of list so that departments can say this is still our subsidy. So if someone's complaining about the fee, that they can realize they're actually still not paying what the actual cost is. And in the case where they are paying the full fee, they'll understand they're only paying that and they're not actually subsidizing someone else. So I think it also shows how expensive it is to do government business. I mean, obviously, there's a lot that goes into these processes and stuff, and so. I'm very glad that we did this. I always like when we're protected from lawsuits, as Tim knows. And so I knew that we were going to have to raise fees, and I'm glad that there's a very sound and fair justification for doing so. So I can support this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I did have one additional question on just sort of the strategy, if you could walk me through it. On 11A-66 in the staff report, and this is a engineering thing, so feel free to jump in, Don. Fortunately, the questions that I have are in categories where the fees to begin with are not significant. But if you could walk me through one more time, if you look at fee number 24 and fee number 29 and fee number 32. This is all under grading inspection permit, non-subdivision. The recovery rate is 136%, 511%, and 283%, respectively. Once again, these fees by comparison are, not really significant in terms of an overall, increment of a project, the grading aspect of a project. But the rationale is more what I was interested in. Why do we have the current fee and the full cost recovery being much lower, leading to a recovery rate of well over 100%?
Those are the four fees I mentioned for engineering that are currently over recovering. We maintain the same fee structure, if I'm correct. We maintain the same fee structure that you've been using. We just recalculated the cost. It simply is that your current fees that were established some time ago were too high. And so when we calculated the actual cost for providing this incremental service, what these fees are is you have a baseline of a particular size of grading, 100,000 cubic yards, for example. And then in order to get up to the next baseline, we have to have an increment that works up to that point. So it's you have a base fee, and what you're seeing there, the ones you're looking at, are for each additional, say, 10,000 cubic yards up until the next size threshold. And because there really aren't that many of those that happen, and it was sort of small to begin with, even though there's a significant percentage increase, the actual dollar increases, or decreases in this case, I should say, are rather small, and the impact on your revenues are very small because there's just not that much activity in those particular categories annually.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying, if we look at each additional 10,000 cubic yards has a fee of $66, and that fee is good all the way up to 100,000 cubic yards?
That's the additional increment for each additional from the – in which fee number are you looking at, by the way? I'm sorry.
I'm looking at 28 and 29. Or I'm sorry, 29 and 30.
29 and 30. Okay. This is for the category of 10,001 to 100,000 cubic yards. So for the first 10,000 cubic yards, the recommended fee is $791, which is basically full cost. Each additional 10,000 cubic yards, which is fee number 29, that's the increment. And the cost recovery is, I think, simply because the recommended fee is to leave it at where it had been as opposed to changing it to what the full cost, which is a potential reduction. Why that occurred would have to
I think if you look at all these fees are basically a couple different types of fees, and they're broken down into different categories, you know, based upon the actual level of the work. If you combine them all, you'll find it's less than 100% cost recovery. So the overall fee is justified by the work going into that fee. The way we broke it down is to try to just make it equitable, more equitable for the type of work that's going into a particular type of category, if that makes sense. Because certain categories would, we think, inequitably be charged a much larger portion if you strictly broke it down by the, by the full cost recovery that they determine. I think the important thing is the overall fee is justified by the hours that go into that particular fee. It's just how we break them down is the question.
Well, if we generalize grading as an overall category of
exactly.
of a project, this would certainly level out. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But I was just struck by those subcategories that popped out. I was just
right. That makes it. That definitely complicates it.
Okay.
May I make a quick comment on that? Follow up that the blending is a pretty common approach to try and smooth out some of the differences between fees, and the grading, the structure of the grading fees comes from the building code, I believe. So it's sort of set that way in the state codes, and so we sort of live with that structure, even though it's kind of cumbersome.
Okay. Well, obviously the process that you went through, Chad, that you described, and the fact that the involved department heads are sitting here and nodding their assent and approval, I'm assuming, of the of the results. I want to thank you for the work that went into this. It was obviously an extensive, time-consuming, arduous process, but I think we have a good result here and one that is defensible. I think probably what would help in terms of setting this out in front of the public would be, in case someone does ask, if we could have that kind of a if they start saying, well, what does Grover charge or what does Pismo charge or so on and so forth, it would help if we could maybe have just a general scale or a bottom line comparison and to the extent that we can compare apples to apples. So, bottom line for me on this study, I'm very happy we have it, and I can certainly support it this evening.
Mayor? I just wanted to let Councilman Fellows know that we do have that percentage that you had asked about. It's 55%.
Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah, sure.
What's the lifetime on this kind of a study? Since we've, in most cases, we're way under the current full cost recovery, can we use this if 20 years from now we're still not hitting this full cost recovery? I understand we can do the CPI thing, but can we also just
since we have this study that's 20 years old, would we have to redo it at some point?
Well, unless you're going to see reductions in salaries and benefits and budgeted costs, this study can serve as a baseline for years to come. If you decide, and I'm just going from my own hypothetical here, if you decide that next year you want to not only raise by CPI but move even closer towards full cost recovery, well, you still have the same baseline to do that. And the worksheets that staff develop, the recommended fees on and so forth, are, you have those, so you can continue to do that into the future. As for the life of a study like this, my typical recommendation is to use it for a 3 to 5 year time span. 3 years would be if you have staffing changes and change in the way you do business and just structural changes in the organization, that kind of thing. 3 years is probably a good time to do it because you're going to miss out on things otherwise. If you have a reasonably consistent operating practice and staffing stays reasonably consistent, then I think 5 years is a reasonable time frame. When you get beyond that, you start to really lose track of what your costs are over the time period, just as you had perhaps this last time you hadn't done a fee study for more like six, 7 years. You just end up, when you finally do a study again, you have the same sort of sticker shock where you have these giant gaps between what you're charging and what your full cost is. And if you just do regular studies, it mitigates that kind of shock of the size of the gaps. So my recommendation is 3 to 5 years, basically.
One of the things we did like in evaluating the consultant's proposal is the tables and tools that they provide to us. We think it better enables us to keep these things updated for a longer period of time. So you notice in the resolution, it still presents the prior practice of automatically increasing fees just by a cost of living adjustment. I think maybe every few years we'll want to go back and just based on our increased cost, plug those into the table he has to get a more actual update. And then, when you get into 7 and 8 years, then you need to start looking at redoing the whole thing. But if we can keep it up date longer ourselves, that prevents the need to do it as often.
It does strike me that we're driven as much by the comparative median as we are by what the actual costs are. So, that's really what we're going to look at in the future, as just like we did this time, whether if we really went to increase any of these as much as the CPI. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, I have another question. Now that we know the figure is 55% that we may be shooting for, Chad, how does that compare to other communities that you've worked with that are comparable to ours? Because I have a question keeps coming to my mind. We talk about getting close to full cost recovery. We're not ever going to get there because taxes need to pay for the things that we do for the common good, because taxes are paid by common taxpayers. So what's the answer?
First of all, just a clarification of definition. In this case, the full cost recovery that I'm referring to is just for fee-related activities. So I'm not considering in these sort of general services. And secondly, it's almost impossible to answer your first question because it varies so wildly. I have clients of similar size and larger and smaller that have gone for 100% in every case. They're very super aggressive and they just want to recover as much revenue as possible. And there are others who say, you know what, we don't want to do anything. We kind of like where we are. Even though we see this study, we don't want to upset our developers. We don't want to upset the community. We've got an election coming up. We don't want to do anything. So it's really difficult to answer that. A 55% cost recovery, given the range I just gave you from 100% to zero, is right smack in the middle. So I'm giving you somewhat of a cop-out answer, but I can't give you a better one because it does vary so wildly.
Okay, thank you. I think at least here we have a study that's, it's very obvious, fits our city, our community, and that's a good thing.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, if not, I'll entertain a motion. We have a resolution here.
I move a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adopting the city's master fee schedule.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Before we take action, there is an amended or a supplemental out there with a modified resolution. It includes the cost of living adjustment in the substance of the resolution. I wanted to make sure that was included in the motion.
There's a small handout that came out.
As modified.
It has the same title, though.
Yes. Council Member Guthrie?
Are we doing roll call?
Well, so we're okay, good. Now that you've read that small amendment, okay. Now we'll do roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. We will take a about a 12-minute break. We'll come back at 10 after the hour and finish up. Okay, council is back in session. And we'll move at this time to item 11B, fiscal year 07-08, first quarter budget status. Good evening, Angie.
Good evening.
Remember the sandwich technique.
Okay, I'm going to give you good news. Okay, as this first slide shows, the purpose of the first quarter review is to provide a reconciliation of the expected and the actual year-end general fund balance for fiscal year 2007-2008. It's to recommend the reappropriation or carryovers of prior year budgets for services and products that were begun but not completed as of June 30th, 2007. Conduct a review of city funds to recommend budgetary changes to address known budget deficiencies. And identify budget changes that materially impact fund balances. And with that being said, after making all year-end closing entries, it was discovered that fiscal year 2006-2007 revenues were significantly below what I had originally estimated. Since these estimates were used for the base when staff was preparing the biannual budget projections, it has caused shortfalls in both years. This slide shows the revenue decreases and improved increases in expenditures. Property tax is being decreased by $420,000, and an error was made in calculating the fiscal year 2006-07 estimated actual number when preparing the 2007-09 annual budget, biannual budget, I'm sorry, due to the expectation of an additional payment. This caused the current budget to be overstated. Triple flip sales tax is being decreased by $206,000. And the reason that is we recently received notice that the state had overpaid us by $106,000. The actual amount the city will receive or should receive is $862,000 this year, but they're going to back out $106,000. Staff originally budgeted $962,000, so the $206,000 will get us back down to what we'll actually receive. Transit occupancy tax is being reduced by $50,000, and this is due to a delay in the completion of the Hampton Inn project. Operating transfers are being reduced by $7,360, and this is due to budgeting from the local sales tax fund a full year for the battalion chief, and we only have 9 months. We hired the battalion chief at the end of September, so we had a little bit of revenue that we're not going to receive from the sales tax fund. Five Cities Youth Basketball, this is kind of a wash because we're also going to reduce expenditures. Any revenue that exceeds expenditures is returned to the Five Cities Youth Basketball League, and this amount was budgeted in expenditures, but it's actually treated as a refund, so we're going to back that out and just give it to them through the revenue. Salary increases were approved by council, and this is for management and part-time salaries, and it's $149,160. An increase in the legal service contracts for our city attorney of $15,000 and approved historical society membership of $2,500. This is a total reduction of $868,520. The approved 2007-08 budget had a surplus of $399,147, so this gives us a budget shortfall of $469,373. In order to balance the budget, staff is making the following recommendations. An increase in personnel transfers due to the salary increases, and personnel transfers are the money that we receive from other funds, such as water, sewer, to reimburse staff, since all of these
are generally charged to the general fund, but we do services for the water fund. So instead of charging percentages to the actual funds, we have them repaid. Battalion chief reimbursement of $13,000. When we budgeted this from Grover Beach, the reimbursement, I did not include enough there, so that we're actually going to get $13,000 more. User fee increases, we're estimating around $80,000 increase this year, and that was through the improved user fee study that we just heard from. OCSD reimbursement of $15,000 for fire personnel. We're asking for an insurance refund of $56,400. We're actually asking for $90,000 on the refund, but we had already budgeted $33,600 in that, and we thought we were going to get a refund from them, but what they actually did was they just took it off of our workers' comp, so it was taken off our expenditures. So you'll also see a decrease in our expenditures, so it's a wash kind of. Triple flip revenue for VLF is actually $21,355 more than we budgeted, and this is per the county. And fire strike team reimbursement of $114,230. And this doesn't match what we're actually saying as an increase for overtime based on the fires. And the reason that is we're also reimbursed for the apparatus, any vehicles that we use. There's an admin fee in there, so we actually do get more than what the actual staff time. And PG&E lease of $30,000. So that gives us a total increase in revenue of $353,985. And here is the workers' comp that I told you we'd also see a decrease because they actually took the refund off of our expenditures. We're asking for an increase in contractual services of $10,000 for some personnel issues. We're asking to eliminate a community development intern position for $12,000. Public Works contractual services is going to be reduced by $15,000. Public Works, they're actually going to charge directly to some CIP projects, so some salary time is going to be charged to the actual project, so we're predicting about a 10% or $10,000. Police overtime, a decrease of $15,000. And we're also asking for $15,000 reduction in capital transfers, which is going to be replaced by Prop 1B funding. All of the departments were asked to reduce their services and supplies accounts by 2%, and that gives us $39,024. And we asked the Public Works Department to delay a purchase of a vehicle for $27,000. Mandated cost recovery services is going to be reduced by $4,600. The actual contract is a lot less than we had originally estimated. This is because mandated costs are, because of the state budget, are going down what they'll reimburse, so we're not being charged as much. Operating transfers are being reduced by $10,000, and this is due to the transportation fund paying more for the streets. The general fund usually makes up the difference. We had a little bit more in a transportation fund, so we switched that out. Here again is the Five Cities Youth Basketball, what I mentioned before. And fire overtime related to the fire strike team, $62,000 increase. And PG&E park and ride lot, we're asking for an increase of $2,000 for some miscellaneous improvements. And this is a total expenditure decrease of $122,453. And this one slide shows you kind of how we get to where we got. We have the shortfall, and then the revenue increase, and the expenditure decrease, and then total operating increase, we're estimating about $7,000. So here we have the fiscal year 2007-08 beginning fund balance, less the carryovers, and that gives you our available fund balance. We're saying once these budget recommendations have been approved, or if, we'll have an operating increase of $7,065, and our adjusted fund balance for 6/30/08 will be approximately $1.6 million. Here's the sandwich isn't working here. This is the bad news. We will not be at our 15% goal, and it will be at 11%. We are hopeful that we will get at the 15% over time. And with that being said, I'm open to any questions.
Okay. Questions for Angie? I know you have questions, don't you?
Well, actually, they
answered all my questions in an email earlier, but...
Okay, well, that's good then. You don't have any then.
This is slightly different than what was in the staff report, so I'm a little confused by part of this. But I guess the first question, in the staff report, it indicated that we expected to be at about 12% at the end of 08. And it basically said over the rest of this biannual budget that we would not actually gain on the current situation.
Well, we're hoping that department savings will get us close to the 15%. You know, I'm hopeful that in 2 to 3 years we'll be there. Normally, when we close the year, we do actually have a little bit of a savings. Not all expenditures are made. Projects aren't completed, so that we are somewhat close to it. And looking at my staff report, I see 11%, so I'm not sure with the 12, unless I maybe made an error somewhere. But
yeah, I remembered it wrong, too. Just essentially that we were making, that the adjustments we were making, no gain on increasing the reserve.
Correct. We're just hoping savings will get us.
Continuing to
Maybe I can define our strategy a little better. What we'd like to do is wait to the end of this fiscal year and see with these additional cuts, you know, it's going to make the ability to generate those savings a little more challenging, but we're confident we will have, as a result of some efforts we're continuing to do to monitor those costs closely, that we will still have some year-end savings. But we'd like to wait to the end of the year, see under this current situation how much savings we do have, and so, you know, what's a reasonable amount given this current budget situation, and then project that forward probably 3 years is what we were targeting. See if just the savings that we're expecting at the end of each year would be enough to get us where we need to be, and if it's not, then whatever the deficiency is, then that we would have to go back and start incorporating it into the revenue and expenditure recommendations in the budget itself.
Yeah, I guess that's part of my concern is I just point out that, I mean, you already have the 2% in here that's built into here, so now you'd need another, I'm going to say another 4%, maybe even 5% in order to save that money in 1 year. That's a year and a half. That's a pretty big step.
Yeah, I think you may have got the 12% the second year of in 08-09.
I'm sorry. I did mean at the end of 09, at the end of the biannual budget, that we'd be at 12%. So in order to save to get all the way to the 15, you'd have to your departmental savings would be an additional 3 or 4%, so up around 5 or 6%. I'm going to say that seems like a lot of savings.
If it's over a three-year period, we're only talking...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you were talking about making it by the end of 08, that you'd have to...
No, we had, I think somewhere in here it mentioned a 3 to 5 year period.
Yeah, that was in there.
Yeah, and the whole objective here is, you know, we are very serious about getting up to that level, but we need to balance it with if we can do it at the same time of maintaining existing service levels, certainly we want to try to come up with a strategy that avoids service level cuts if we can.
The second question I had, and it was prompted from the email, is I know you're projecting that property tax will go up 6% in the current budget. What did you project that it would go up in the last budget? Do you know?
In the prior year?
Yeah.
I believe it was 9%. In this current budget, we use 7% for both years. And talking to the county, 7% is accurate this year, but 5% will be next year. So... you know, we are asking in the staff report for a reduction of $430,000. We want to kind of see how we end the year, if any further cuts need to be brought forward. And we'll do that in July. I do a budget update report, so I'll bring that forward if I think that.
So the $430,000 is building in the assumption of what the starting point is.
Correct.
What the basis is, and 7%. So if it does end up as an average of 6 over the 2 years, then clearly there's going to be. And when you say the county, is that the county assessor's office? Is that Tom Bordenaro's?
Yes.
Those are my only questions. Thanks.
Okay. Councilmember Fellows?
Angie, would you refresh my memory as to triple flip the sales tax and the VLF, please?
Oh, me. You're going to bring me back. I know. It's very confusing. Well, let me see. This was from 2004. And the state
was replacing our sales tax with property tax. And I cannot recall exactly why the state, it's something to do with their bonding, I believe, that they could not use sales tax, but they could, or they could not use property tax, correct? And they could use sales tax. So they replaced our sales tax with property tax so they could use it for their bonding purposes. It's very, very confusing. So
this is getting, we're getting that back from the state?
Yes, yes. So what it is they're taking it from our sales tax, replacing it with property tax. We account for it in a different line item just so we can kind of track it a little bit better because we know exactly, usually they tell us exactly what we're going to receive. However, they don't tell us that they're overpaying us. They base it on estimates of what they think we're going to get in sales tax, and that's what they pay us. And if they compare it to what we actually got in sales tax, and that was over or less, they will either give us more money or take away. And in this instance, we came in a lot lower, so they're taking the $106,000 away. I will say that we're not the only one in this situation. You know, several of the cities in the area and the county had a huge overpayment. So there are others struggling with this. Some of them got refunds. So it's across the board.
All right. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah, just to... the state put a fancy label on this called ERAF, and which it was, what is it, Earned Revenue or Estimated Revenue Allocation Fund or something like
it's
that.
Educational Reimbursement Augmentation Fund.
Augmentation Fund. They put a label on it that, essentially took our, that essentially relabeled it from what it really was, which was grand theft, and that money was being allocated to pay the schools, and at least that's what they said they were going to do with it. But that whole process led to the League of Cities effort and Prop 1A, and which now put in place a constitutional amendment that said they can't do that anymore. However, they can borrow, which was leading me to my question, and that is that if they choose to exercise Prop 1A, and I realize that's going to shoot just about every municipal budget completely, off the board. Have we even thought ahead to that instance at all?
I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, I know. Nobody wants to think about it, but...
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think the huge thing that the league has been successful in is getting additional protections. While they can still borrow, they now have to repay us within, I think,
Within three years.
So before...
With interest.
Before, we were really forced to incorporate that into our budget because we didn't even know if we'd ever get it back, and usually we didn't. Now the fact that we know we'll get it back in 3 years, we would probably recommend, as long as we can keep the reserves up to, it's not up to our minimum, but still up to an adequate level that could probably accommodate it, only because we're confident we could get it back, and then the money would just be folded back into the reserves at that time, since it would be a true loan versus their former loans that didn't always end up as loans.
Well, the only reason why I mention it is because this time last year, obviously there was some talk about them exercising that clause in Prop 1A, and the thinking was back there that it really wouldn't benefit the state, particularly with the interest payment, for them to do it. However, this year, at the last league board meeting, the admonishment was going around again to hold on to your reserves. And, given the last report that's coming out of Sacramento about the condition of the state budget, there are a lot of people, now thinking that they may well exercise that clause. So
the state is estimating a $10 billion deficit for 2008-09. So we'll have to keep watching and see if that's what's going to happen. I believe the governor is going to release a budget in early January, so I'll be watching for that and see if what's going to happen. So like Steve said, it would have to come from reserves right now, and we'd have to account for it as that. And the good thing is we are getting repaid. 3 years ago, they took $243,000 2 years in a row. We didn't get that back. So at least we're going to get some of it back. You know, it's not completely lost, but they will not probably repay it until the very last moment. So,
okay. The other question I had was, Angie, on the Prop 1B supplement, is that funding that we already have, so that we don't have to, if I understand this correctly, you know, that would be money that we would use instead for our CIP. Is that Prop 1B money that we already have or is allocated to us, or do we have to go back and ask for more?
It's money that's allocated to us and approved. We just have to submit our projects and draw it down at this point.
Okay. And then the other thing that jumped out was the community development intern position. Is that a position that is already currently occupied, or is that one that's vacant that
it's vacant at this time.
Okay. And the public works vehicle, is that the one that we approved at the last meeting, or is that an additional one?
No, that was one. I think we mentioned they had been approved for two vehicles. And so the one had been delayed due to budget, and that's why the other one that was remaining was in pretty severe condition, so it allowed them to move forward. But we thought this other one would be certainly a good candidate for the hybrid vehicle, as well as another one. I think they have budget in that year also, so we're certainly moving ahead and continuing to look at that technology for those vehicles.
Okay. All right, those are all. Excuse me, all of my questions. Once again, this is not a public hearing, but we do have members of the public in the audience. Anyone who would like to come forward on 11B, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. No takers. We'll close public comment on 11B and bring this back to the council, and we'll start with Councilmember Fellows.
I can support their recommendation made by staff.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
I can also support the recommendation, but I do have some real serious concerns about some of the assumptions going forward, and I almost think that waiting till the end of the fiscal year is going to be too late. And I do think we need to take a look at the first quarter and be prepared to move them, because I really do think we all had some indication that this was going south 6 months ago and didn't make any real adjustment at that point. So I do think at the end of this quarter that I'd like to have a serious review of where the property tax, and that may not, I know that they pay at odd times and not according to our schedule, but that we do need to have serious review of that. I also would like to see us take a look at the sales tax assumptions as they relate to the budget, but also as they relate to our capital program in the local tax, and really project where that's going to leave us over the next 10-year period. I do think we may have to reprioritize that as well. My concern is that if we wait too long to make this adjustment, it's going to be a much bigger adjustment than we would otherwise have to make. And yeah, I agree, we don't need to make up the reserve all at once, but we did just, you know, reduce our reserve goal. We've really gone all the way from, I think we were at about 18%, now we're all the way to 11. My concern is we're going to be all the way at 5, and then we really have no reserve to deal with the state or somebody like that. So I think at this point, I think you guys have done a great job of moving things around to make a reasonable expectation of where we're going. But I do think that if the particularly the revenue assumptions are incorrect, we still have some fairly big expenditure issues out there as well that are still coming down the road that could break this budget in a heartbeat. So I think the end of the year is probably too late. I'd like to see a serious review so that we're ready at the end of the year. We've already sort of gone through the pain of whatever it might take, and we're not starting in July and hoping to institute the changes in September. That would be my point.
Yeah, if I could just respond to that, I think that's pretty consistent with what we want to do. We agree with all the analysis that you had mentioned that we would do immediately, and that would prepare us for what we were recommending is to not make any final plan on how we how we over time accommodate the increase in the reserve until we have a chance to analyze kind of what our year-end savings are. But all the items that you had mentioned in terms of analysis, we agree that those are things that we'd like to move forward quickly with to start putting that data together and have a overall analysis. And then at the end of the year, we can look at the year-end savings and make an immediate recommendation on where we want to go from there.
Also, I just wanted to add that in February, I'll be doing the mid-year report, so we'll get a better idea of where we're at the halfway point. And so anytime that we think that it's still going to come in lower, we're going to do the same thing we did here. We're going to, you know, work around it, see what we can do and make any adjustments. So, and then again, we'll do the third quarter. So there are two more reports that will come forward and we'll be watching and seeing how we're doing. But again, mid-year will be a good point for us. We're halfway. We'll have, you know, the halfway of the property taxes. So that'll tell us a little bit. Sales tax, I think I told you in the email, we're currently at 26% instead of the 26 or 27%, which is above what we estimated. So that's a little bit better there. So hopefully we're doing okay, but, you know, I'll bring it back to you in the mid-year report in February and we can make any cuts or adjustments then.
Thank you. Okay. Councilmember Costello.
I can support the adjustments to Schedule A and B and going forward with what we've got tonight, but I do echo the caution that we stay on top of this.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I too can support the changes tonight. Obviously, I've been the one that's been really concerned about the property tax issue, and I'm really amazed that they're actually estimating that it's going to go up at all next year. So I just can't echo that enough. So I definitely support staying on top of this as close as we can and really being diligent. But thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, you sort of did stay with the sandwich technique. I mean, we're making the best of a bad situation, and I think the good news for us is that we've been I think vigilant prior to this last anomaly with regard to those factors, some of which we have control over, some we don't. But I think the main goal right now has got to be a focus on our reserves and ways in which if we come out just a few dollars ahead to the extent that we possibly can, we need to bolster our reserves. And that without question is our fallback position. I did have a chance to mention, in fact, I didn't bring it up, but the whole issue of the budget came up at our mayor's meeting last Friday. And you know, we clearly are not alone in this, and it's all over the county, including the county, and it is primarily property tax and sales tax. The other issue that came up with regard to property tax was the fact that the outlook is not rosy, because apparently a lot of people, with the real estate market being what it is, are asking for reassessments, and they're in many cases they're getting them. So if that's the case, then we can expect those revenues. We can anticipate that those revenues may diminish further. But in terms of forecasting, I've always trusted your judgment, Steve, and Angie as well. I know that you do the best you can, and I think what we have to realize is that while we can continue being fiscally conservative, and we should, and at least during the next couple of years, I think we need to be very vigilant. I'm appreciative of the belt tightening that the departments are going through right now. I know it's not a pleasant thing to do, but it's a necessary thing to do. But I think we also have to realize that we have control to a limited degree over some of those things. But some of the other major factors, not knowing what the state's going to do, recognizing that the state probably doesn't know what it's going to do, those are things we have little control over, and that's why I think we need, again, to continue to be vigilant about the status of our reserves, just because of the fact that those things materialize beyond our control. So I'm appreciative of the work that has gone into the status report. again, we're making the best of a bad situation, and I think the strategy is sound. So we'll go forward and keep our fingers crossed. So I need a motion, if there's nothing further, I need a motion for staff's recommendation.
Mr. Mayor, I move we approve Schedules A and B as adjusted in the report.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Okay, hearing none. Roll call.
Council Board Member Costello?
Yes.
Council Board Member Fellows?
Yes.
Council Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Vice Chair Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Chair Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, that takes us to item 11C, consideration of the selection of Council Member Fellows for Mayor Pro Tem.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have, is there any discussion? Roll call.
Who second?
I did.
Oh, you did. Okay. Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
For the last time, Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
And we'll probably play musical chairs, especially over here, because these guys are too chatty.
I know it's coming.
Okay, we'll move to item 12, City Council Member items. We do have a couple of them this evening. And the first, Mayor Pro Tem, the request to provide temporary alternatives, temporary basketball hoops in the public right-of-way.
Yes. This actually came up. A resident gave me a phone call concerned with the current policy right now. Obviously, with the way that we enforce a lot of these issues is if there's complaints driven. And this is a person who lives over in Rancho Grande. They live in a cul-de-sac. The majority of the neighborhood has hoops out on their streets. The driveways in the neighborhood happen to be somewhat sloping, but the street itself is fairly flat. And a lot of the residents have these out in the street. They're filled with sand, so they're quite heavy. There was a change in the neighborhood where one new resident moved in and then started complaining, and so the city has now gone out and is basically requesting that the hoops be removed when they're not being used. They can be brought back out in the street when they are being used. The dilemma this creates is, in this person's instance, is the wife isn't strong enough to actually to move the hoop. It has about 450 pounds of sand in it, and so therefore this is causing basically a conflict with our policy. And he actually did some research and found some other cities that have a more reasonable, they have a different way of looking at it, which is basically if it doesn't impede public safety and have some other basically rules, and it doesn't require the neighborhood to be placed as far as parking and stuff, that they don't have to bring them off the street. And so what I'd like to do is have staff basically look at some alternatives. We may not want to change it at all, but I would at least like to look at it from more of a, I'm looking at it kind of from a fairness standpoint. I realize that we definitely are driven by complaint, but in this case, this was a neighborhood that was working really fine until one neighbor changed, and now it's basically changed the dynamics of the neighborhood a lot. And so I realize there are going to be neighborhoods where this is not going to be a viable policy because of parking or other issues, but I think there may be some areas in our city where leaving the hoops in the street might be a reasonable policy. So I'd just like to have staff bring back some alternatives.
Okay. And question. Did, in fact, pose a bit of a obstruction. And it was tough because of the narrowness of the street and impeding in parking. And I think there was even a an issue with one of the utilities. I'm not sure what it was. I can't remember what it was, but it was one of the utilities that actually complained about the placement of it. And but beyond that, there are areas in the city that. Where there is activity in the street, it does create a safety issue. And while, you know, the widths of streets and the circumstances, and I think that's what you're asking for, sort of a flexible case-by-case look at how you apply this, it's tough to create that, though. It's tough to create a double standard. And from an enforcement standpoint, it does create some issues, but we can certainly look at it and see what staff comes up with. I don't have a problem with that.
Great. Yeah, we'd be glad to bring back some alternatives. Our current approach, we've tried to structure it so somewhat kind of in between in terms of different approaches we've seen, not overly restrictive, but also provide some restrictions. There's been a huge proliferation of these basketball hoops recently, though, so it's causing us a problem. So I think it's good timing for us to get some direction from you in terms of, you know, what your direction would you would like to see on this issue. So I'll have that back next month.
Can I make a comment at this point? I think we need to keep in mind that if they all go away, they're just more excuses for young people to stay inside and do what they do, whatever they do that I don't do. We need to encourage people to get out and get some exercise, but obviously we need some standards, street width or whatever, that if there's clearance, I'd like to see some of the hoops remain.
Yeah. Our current policy has not expressed anything negative about the kids playing with the hoops in the street. Our basic enforcement has been to not leave them unattended so they fall over, which is a danger, and to get, you know, to get them in onto the private property once they're finished. But as Mayor Pro Tem Arnold mentioned, that presents some challenges just based on the weight of the equipment. So we'll come up with a number of alternatives and see what you'd like to do.
Thank you.
The person's private.
That was it. It was a homeowners association issue that they couldn't resolve themselves. They asked us to get involved in it or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how it develops. The other item 12B is one that I brought through and forth, and you know, I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other. This, you know, just some quick background. At the last League of Cities board meeting, there was some interest to pay special tribute to Tom Bradley, the former mayor of city of Los Angeles. Tom Bradley was very active in the League of Cities, and in fact, he was the last president of the National League of Cities from California. And somebody brought up the idea, the Los Angeles division of the league brought up the idea of a commemorative stamp, and they asked councils around the state to weigh in on it. So I don't know. Do you have that? Did this get in the agenda packets, Kelly?
Just a line
on it for next time.
Yeah, but there was an information thing on it. There was a sample resolution from the league. I didn't know if you got it or not. Anyway, it's just yay or nay if you want to, you know, endorse it. So we can bring it forward if you want. Take a look at it. See what you want to do. Again, I don't have any strong feelings either way.
I don't have a problem if it comes forward and we can look at it.
Yeah. Okay.
LAPD, though, right?
What's that?
He was LAPD, wasn't he?
Yeah, we won't hold that against them. Okay. Item 13, city manager items. None this evening? You sure you don't want to talk about the fine structure, Steve?
I will.
Okay. council communication? Any letters, comments? Anyone talking?
I have a couple of members of the public ask me how the Branch Street, West Branch Street repairs are coming along.
And I was going to bring that up under staff communications.
So. Wait till then.
Was that it?
That's it.
Okay, staff communications.
Okay, yes. Wanted to get back to you. I mentioned this closed off the street immediately. At the last meet, I mentioned to you that we're going to go ahead under emergency basis to issue a bid and get the work going. This past week, Public Works did get three bids and three informal bids. We issued the contract Friday. They began work Monday, and they're expected to complete the work by Friday. It was toast paving Total cost was $35,000, which was much under the bids, ranged all the way up to over $80,000. We've met with the county, and they've told us to submit a claim. They apologized. It didn't appear that there's going to be any difficulty in getting the reimbursement. They didn't they weren't arguing the situation at all. And so we understand the frustration of residents because it is very cumbersome. But at the same time, we think Public Works moved very rapidly to get this repaired about as quickly as I think you can do it. So, and we're going to be releasing a press release to that effect to let the folks know what we did to get that resolved. Oh, and then lastly, at the next agenda, we will need to bring back the bid for council consideration to confirm the issuance of the bid on an emergency basis.
You bring that back when?
At the next meeting in January 8th.
Right, but the work's going to come.
Will be done. It's the state code with the resolution we have in place allows the city manager on an emergency basis to have the work done. It's the confirmation of the award of that bid still needs to be done by the city council at a later date.
Okay. Anything else?
No, sir.
I still think on your press release that we need to include the radio and the TV media, the local KSBY.
And we do on all the press releases,
okay.
I think, on almost all of them.
Send some to KVEC for their morning program. So, okay. That takes us to item 16, community comments and suggestions. We have no community left except for Rob, and he doesn't count. Don't take it personal. And item 17 is adjournment.
So moved.
Thank you, gentlemen.